Hello and welcome to Technically Legal. This is podcast 81 for December 21st, 2010. I'm Dominic Rabier.
I'm Ben Snitkoff.
And I'm David O'Brien.
We've got two great stories for you this week. We're doing a slightly abbreviated holiday edition. First case, we have the WoW Glider decision between MDY Industries and Blizzard Entertainment. And then we have the very interesting Warshak case regarding Fourth Amendment protection of emails. We'll dive right into our first case, which is the MDY Industries versus Blizzard Entertainment case. Basically, Blizzard, the makers of the very popular video game World of Warcraft, encountered this company called MDY Industries, which is just one guy, basically, with the initials MDY, and he wrote a bot for the popular WoW, and effectively this bot would allow players to just start the bot, and the bot would play the game for them. Blizzard sent some lawyers to his house in 2006, after having implemented various technological measures to try to catch him. One of them is called Warden. Basically, what it does is it runs and looks at the memory of a computer to see whether the memory signature of a bot is present, and if so, it'll try to shut it down or disconnect the players from the game. In any case, they sent a bunch of lawyers to his house in 2006 and were like, you've got to stop this, rah, rah, rah. And so he brought a declaratory judgment lawsuit, which basically says, court, show that I'm not infringing copyright, because Blizzard was alleging that under the terms of the license agreement and terms of use of the World of Warcraft game itself, because when users log on, they have to agree to the terms of use, the Blizzard's basic case was that users using his bot were committing copyright infringement, and so he was liable for vicarious copyright infringement in terms of encouraging these users to use the bot, which then enabled them to do copyright infringement. The theory was that by violating the provisions of the license, that would constitute copyright infringement. This went through district court and now arrived at the Ninth Circuit, and the Ninth Circuit just ruled effectively that for the purposes of this license, because the terms in the license were covenants, not conditions of the license, then it made it so that because they were covenants, in other words, the difference between covenants and conditions, the court held, is that a covenant is something that doesn't necessarily impinge copyright infringement in that it isn't a precursor to the actual license being effective. In other words, you agree to the license, and then if you violate a covenant, well, you've broken the license, but you haven't broken copyright infringement necessarily. Whereas a condition is something that's a prerequisite to the license itself.
Right. Essentially that a covenant is something that you agree to and doesn't have any sort of basis in copyright. Meanwhile, a condition is. So a condition of the license would be like you agree not to make or distribute any further copies. A covenant would be you agree not to use any type of computer automation to play the game for you, because you can't really... you can't protect the latter right, preventing somebody from using the software in a particular way under copyright. That's not really one of the enumerated copyrights. David, any initial thoughts on this?
This is truly all about the differences between contract law and copyright law. And as we know, and we've covered a lot on the show before, there are the enumerated rights, the exclusive rights that a copyright holder gets under the Copyright Act. Often in the case of software and offerings, there are terms associated with access to the software, and in some cases when it's installed locally, there's a EULA at play, which usually governs the installation locally, and then if you're connecting to some sort of service in the cloud, in this case it's a gaming server, there's also terms of use that are associated with that. So the difference between copyright and contract law there is that while you can protect something both that's a copyright, effectively an exclusive right under the Copyright Act, also under contract law, just because you call something sort of disfavored conduct or restricted actions or activities through a terms of use agreement, it does not necessarily mean that it's a violation of the Copyright Act, even though what you might be contracting for is use of some sort of copyrighted work like software. Also, in the case, though, which I thought was interesting, was not just that there were two different parts of the opinion. One was about whether you could have a copyright violation by violating either a covenant or a condition of a license. That was the first half. The second half was about the anti-circumvention provisions in the Copyright Act.
Right, and specifically whether or not Glider itself circumvented effective copyright protection.
The key difference in the wording, actually, between the two provisions is one blocks circumventing a technological measure that effectively controls access to a work protected under copyright law, versus the other provision, which is circumventing protection afforded by a technological measure that effectively protects the right of a copyright owner. That's a pretty subtle difference that the court got into.
Right, and the court got into that subtle difference in several different ways. The most interesting one that I found, and this in some ways affirmed earlier decisions in other circuits and in some ways disagreed with it, was that, and I believe the analogy the court used was that if the front door is locked but the back door is open, circumventing the front door lock, it doesn't amount to a violation of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which just is to say that if you circumvent some copy protection to get at something that you could get at without circumventing the copy protection, you are not violating the DMCA.
And the language in the statute has been tortured now for some time in the court system, I think. And just to illustrate that, if you look at page 22 in the PDF of the decision, and side by side they have section 1201A2 and 1201B1, and they do a comparison with bolded portions in the statutory language just to show you how closely worded they are and how the distinction is very subtle.
And it's basically two lines of difference. So why is this case important? Like, why is this such a big deal? What was the big thing that the court did in this decision that they said that copyright owners don't have a right to do, that Blizzard was trying to assert that they did?
Well, let's go to the first part, going back to the distinctions between copyright and contract law. What a lot of people have been worried about for some time now is that owners of copyrights will find new ways to protect their works through contract law, because basically, if you're interacting with elements on a computer, whether it's software or whether it's content that you're viewing through a web browser, you usually encounter some form of contract that limits the way that you can use the software or the copyrighted work. Since it's so easy to make somebody, agree to a EULA in the case of like a click wrap agreement, you have to click through and say, I agree to the following terms. It would also be very easy for a person who owned a work to sort of attach additional protections on top of what the Copyright Act has granted them. Now, for a very long time, prior to when computers were popularly used in homes, this was seen as okay. It was private ordering economically. People would, negotiate the terms of agreements. These were sophisticated parties, corporations, business to business type things. They could afford to have attorneys to go in and interpret the provisions and, make sure that they got whatever both parties wanted, right? You can't so much do that anymore when it's terms of use agreements and contracts are almost ubiquitous. So the first concern is that beyond those exclusive rights that are enumerated in the Copyright Act, people will be able to add additional rights that aren't necessarily under the Copyright Act, but they could call them copyright violations if it ever became the subject of a lawsuit. Now, the other part to this is that contract law is different than copyright law. Under the Copyright Act, we have statutory damages, and in the case of willful violations of copyright law, the spectrum of damages available is $750 to $150,000. And that, in some cases, it depends on the circumstances. If there is a lawsuit that is eventually filed that involves one of these contracts, the damages available to a litigant are much different under contract law than under the Copyright Act and that statutory damages provision. And in some cases, it can be a lot more under the Copyright Act. And so, if you are able to successfully make a claim that something that you have said is a prohibited activity within a license agreement that involves a copyrighted work, you could also make the argument that you've just violated copyright law and now you owe the person statutory damages within that spectrum, which might be a lot more than a person could get if they just pursued the lawsuit under contract law for breach of contract.
And the court basically said here that you can't do that. Just it's an overreaching. That's not what Congress intended in terms of the copyright provisions.
It sounds very clear when we talk about it like this, but in terms of what the exclusive rights actually are that are enumerated in the Copyright Act, the right to reproduction, distribution, public performance, public display, and creation of derivative works, you could fit a lot of different activities into one of those little holes, okay? So creation of a derivative work could be a lot of different things. That could mean a derivative work, for instance, could be the creation of software like Glider. It could be that a copyright owner might in some have the right to make software that automates certain actions on a copyrighted work. So in other words, you know, I think that there is still some leeway under the actual enumerated exclusive rights, and I think there's some wiggle room for people to make creative arguments. This is just another reason why licenses or specific language using them is going to become much more important. And I think the lawyers who are writing these things are paying very close attention to the wording and the way that they're prohibiting certain activities. And
did anyone find the distinction in this opinion, and I guess in the lower court, the district court's opinion, between, I'm stretching to remember the exact language here, but a literal, non-literal, and there's a third type of element.
What about those distinctions, or did you want to just go over the distinctions?
No, I was just wondering if anyone thought that it was interesting, the way they split up what I would think is essentially one big bulk of software, one big bulk of code that's all on somebody's hard drive, whether or not it's interesting that they split it up into three different categories, and the decision comes down differently for each of those three different categories.
Well, I guess the three categories might be worth just spelling out really quickly. Literal elements, which are the source code itself. Individual non-literal elements, which are basically the animations, the visuals, the sounds. And then dynamic non-literal elements, which is the actual experience that people see, basically because it's online with other players. The literal elements is the source code itself. The reason they did this analysis differently is because you don't actually need to even connect to the game server. You just install the game on your hard drive, and you have access to the executable code on your hard drive. You don't have to circumvent anything. So Glider clearly doesn't enable you to do anything that you can't already do yourself with regard to that. And the individual non-literal elements are also encoded in the game's files, I believe. And then there's the dynamic non-literal elements, which are the actual experience that people get, and that isn't something that you can access without being connected to the servers. And since Warden watches for bots like Glider and tries to disconnect them, Glider is trying to get around that sort of thing.
Right, and as a result, while Glider doesn't infringe, well, doesn't violate the DMCA when it allows access to the literal and non-literal elements, it does violate the DMCA where it allows you to access these dynamic non-literal elements, because Glider is, you know, circumventing the effective copy protection of this Warden system that occasionally checks the memory of your computer to look for bots.
Yeah.
Software can be incredibly complex when you're viewing it in light of copyright law, because there are so many different ways that a user might interact with copyrighted elements in a software program. And I think that those distinctions really illustrate exactly that point, that it when you break it down and try to parse out these copyright arguments for individual elements, various portions of the game, you've got, you know, different game files that are interacting differently with other portions of the game. There's client-side software, web server software, and, you know, there's clients interacting through the web server with people who are also connecting to the web server on other clients. That you potentially have, you know, a couple different ways that you can have copyrighted works displaying on a person's computer. So at any rate, I don't know if we've mentioned this, though, the court did eventually hold that they upheld, I should say, the district court's decision that MDY had breached the terms of the license agreement.
I'm sorry, say that last bit again.
So for the first half of the story that we were talking about, with respect to the copyright claims and the prohibitive terms of the license agreement, they said that that was not copyright infringement, but they still said it's a violation of contract law. It's a breach of contract.
It is a breach of contract, but they then remanded it to the lower court to determine whether or not it was tortious interference with a contract. There was some element that the court was stuck up on, and for the life of me, I can't remember what it is off the top of my head right now, but they remanded it to the lower court for further determination as to some level of intent. Let me see if I can find this.
Tortious interference with contract?
Yeah, that was remanded
And then whether he, I think whether he intentionally violated and his personal liability.
Oh, whether it was I thought it was the impropriety of the interference was what specifically what they remanded it for.
Yes.
Yeah,
The
and
district
that.
court may consider the propriety of an injunction if it finds him liable for against him directly, personally. So, go ahead.
Oh, that was all I had to say.
I was just gonna say, have either of you guys ever used the Glider software? Not to implicate you in any copyright infringement lawsuits in the future.
No, when I used to grind, I'd grind the manual way, by going into levels with creatures that were far above my pay grade and getting killed repeatedly.
Anything else on this story? Or go ahead.
Oh no, just an anecdotal bit. Way back in the day, around 1998, maybe 1997 actually, when I was in high school, I was a big fan of Ultima Online, which was one of the first big MMOs. And back then, even people were using these types of software, third-party software, which would help you automate tasks basically in an MMO and help you sort of increase your character's leveling status, among other things. Back then, though, it was much more simple. It was basically macro software that where you could record a series of keystrokes or mouse movements and clicks and have that sort of superimposed on top of the game. So it wasn't actually interacting with any of the code, as far as I could tell. It was just, moving the mouse around and moving your character around. But if you had ever clicked outside of the program, the mouse movement, unless you had stopped the macro, would continue on your desktop clicking around freely until you stopped it. It's sort of interesting to see how much it's actually improved, where you really don't even have to check in anymore on the software in terms of how much it's been automated for MMO gameplay.
It's also interesting to note that Blizzard, for example, recently launched the mobile auction house feature, and what they did is they let people use the economic aspects of the game, not playing the game necessarily, but just the because there's a sort of a virtual economy set up within the game. And one of the consequences of launching the mobile auction house is that they let people access it through iPhone apps and also through a web interface. And because it's a web interface, they actually made it so that it's scriptable. So it's completely legal now to, for example, write an auction house bot that integrates with the open API that they do using JavaScript and stuff like that. So it's interesting to see that they've provided that sort of avenue, if you will, for automating one part of the game.
Yeah, so you can game the economy, but however, if you try to game the actual gameplay, you're interfering with people's ex gameplay experience.
Yeah,
Hey,
which is.
listen, guys, Blizzard says that they've lost subscribers because of this, and I think we should take their
Ooh.
claims seriously.
More than that, according to the opinion here, it says that Blizzard claimed that between December 2004 through March 2008, it had received more than 465,000 complaints about bots used in WoW games.
I have difficulty believing that.
That's a
I what
huge
I find
number.
really difficult to believe is the amount of money this guy apparently made, $3.5 million off of 120,000 licenses for Glider. Like, holy crap. There's only like what, 3 million people playing WoW back then in the US actively? Like 120,000 licenses? Holy crap.
How many active users are there now?
Worldwide, I think it's a little over 13 million, but that includes China, so that number is maybe like 2, 3 to 4 million in North America now. But back in 2005, 2006, it was like 5 or 6 million, and there was nothing in China, but that's still a lot of 120,000 is a ton of licenses for a bot. And these licenses are like $15 to $25 a pop. And furthermore, later on, he actually says in the opinion that he had on his website saying that it was actually against the Blizzard use and you might get banned for it. And people were still paying him money for the chance to potentially get banned, which I find just mind-boggling.
Wow, that's pretty crazy.
In any case, I think the decision is $6.5 million against him, so.
Yeah, and we'll see what happens with some of these other claims on remand, or if at this point it just settles out.
Yeah. Any other thoughts on this story?
I'm all set, David.
I think we're ready to move on.
Okay, our
Right?
next big story this week is that the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals has issued an opinion in which they found that there is a Fourth Amendment right to privacy in one's email. And of all things, this comes out of a case relating to Enzyte, which you probably have seen advertisements for. It's the herbal male enhancement pill that is advertised by Smiling Bob, that really creepy guy who was smiling all the time while playing golf and doing other typical daily activities. Essentially, and the Fourth Amendment ruling here is just one in a series of very complicated rulings in a 90 some odd page opinion, but it basically says that, looking at the way modern life functions and whether or not people have a reasonable expectation of privacy in their email and what, whether or not as a whole society is ready to accept that there's a reasonable expectation of privacy in one's email, the court said that in fact there is. However, and we'll probably get a little more into this later, the court ended up not reversing this case because the federal agents in the case were relying on the Stored Communication Act, which we've talked about before. And because they went through the Stored Communication Act, they will not grant this person a new trial or these persons a new trial because the they were reasonably relying on a act of Congress to get access to these emails without using the Fourth Amendment. So, David or Dominic, gut reactions, first instincts, what are your thoughts here?
We can talk really quick about some of the or why these emails were so critical in this case. There were some 27,000 emails, I think, that were the subject of this particular appeal. But what had apparently happened is that between the company name, I think, which was Berkeley, if I remember that correctly, Berkeley was this nutraceutical company which had come up with these herbal remedies for various things or ways to enhance your life, and Enzyte, which was their flagship product. I think I'm still seeing, by the way, Enzyte in commercials on TV, which is completely crazy considering the extent of the cases that have gone against these guys. But anyway, it started off as a very small company, and over the course of time, as this particular herbal remedy was very popular and sold a lot, the company grew to be over 1,000 people. But there were a lot of emails that went back and forth between some of the people who played key roles at the company that were rather incriminating in terms of the overall effectiveness of the Enzyte stuff. And it also sort of brought to light this scheme, or sounds a lot like a scheme, whereby people were automatically enrolled into a program that would ship them additional Enzyte shipments every month and charge their credit cards, whether they agreed to do that or not. And that seemed to be the heart of the case. They not only had this internal policy whereby people would be automatically enrolled in the auto shipment program, but they would also sort of tell their sales reps to hide that fact and to try to change the subject, or they would use all these weird sales tactics to sort of push people into this auto shipment program that would charge them another like $60 or $70 a month. Following the conviction on what was 100, there was 112 counts in the indictment. They certainly weren't convicted on all of those, but a large number, the majority, I think, according to this court, they then appealed on the basis of the Fourth Amendment rights against unreasonable search and seizures. Just about the emails, though, just about these 27,000 emails.
Yeah, right. And there were a fair number of other issues that were raised in the trial. The other thing that I found was really interesting is the lengths to which the company went to avoid issuing refunds. And in fact, they went through a whole bunch of convoluted kind of twists and turns to lower the chargeback rate because major credit card holders will cancel your accounts with them if people start challenging a lot of the charges that are, put on their account. So they went through a lot of twists and turns to rack up the number of charges that they make to each card. So if they had to refund it, if they had to refund, one, they'd, only refund, one of those three charges and, not refund the shipping and the separate handling charges. Or they also charged the owner of the company, his credit card, $1 charges until they maxed out his credit card, so that they'd get, let's say 10,000 $1 charges. So if one person demands a refund or a chargeback or challenges it, it's just a drop in the bucket compared to all of the other charges that they have, numerically, if not as an average of the value of the charges.
Yeah, and the other thing that apparently that they were alleged to have done, and this was shown in the emails, was they were supposedly falsifying some of the testimonials that they were using in their commercials. And the commercials weren't just on TV; that they were also in print media and other places. And they also falsified at least two researchers who were supposedly behind the creation of the drug and claimed that they were was a doctor from Stanford or a doctor from Harvard. Stanford and Harvard were both implicated in it, but when private investigators actually made phone calls to those universities, it turned out those people did not exist. And there was also some emails which apparently incriminated one particular individual with having created, the statistics to how effective the drug or the effective the herbal remedy was in a 24-hour period to sort of pull these numbers out of the air.
Yep, and most of the charges were mail and wire fraud. But I guess getting back to kind of the core of what's going on here is these Fourth Amendment claims that were made and eventually affirmed by the court. One of the most interesting things that I found in the opinion was that the court kind of flat out says, and unfortunately they say it in a footnote as opposed to, you're making a bigger deal of this, but they had the choice as to whether or not the court wanted to deal with this Fourth Amendment issue. And they could have just said, because we're not going to reach a Fourth Amendment issue, because the feds in this case, the investigators, were relying on the Stored Communication Act, and they were relying on it in good faith, so it doesn't matter whether or not the statute's constitutional. What they did here is they said, listen, we're going to draw a line. We can keep on dodging this issue of not deciding whether or not the Stored Communication Act is constitutional, but we're not going to do that. What we're going to do is we're going to address the issue, but then affirm the conviction because, yes, there is this good faith reliance, but going forward from this day forward, from from today on, any prosecution in the Sixth Circuit cannot rely on the good faith exception to the Stored Communications Act because, as far as the Sixth Circuit is concerned, the Stored Communication Act is unconstitutional.
Wow, that was a mouthful. So maybe before we talk a little bit more about that in detail, it would be good to give a rundown on what exactly the Fourth Amendment is and how it affects search and seizures.
Well, the Fourth Amendment is the Fourth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which says the right to people and their person and property. God, I should just look it up.
The right
Hold
of the
on.
people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue, but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized.
Thank you. So essentially, that's saying you've got a right to privacy in certain things, and without a warrant, the federal government can't just go in and start taking these things. Things that, house is really a common one. Phone calls, they can't tap your phone calls without a warrant. However, they can if you're talking to somebody and that person says it's okay to record, the feds can do that. And the same problem exists with emails. They could go up to, say, the recipient of one of these emails and say, hey, can you hand over these emails? If that person says yes, then you're up the creek. But if they don't have a cooperating party, again in the Sixth Circuit, now the feds would need to get a warrant to get that those emails from your ISP or from your place of work.
We could just even take a real quick step back about reasonable expectations of privacy, which tend to be the heart of the Fourth Amendment. First of all, you have to have a reasonable expectation of privacy in order to get Fourth Amendment protection in the first place, and it's generally calculated on what they call a totality of the circumstances in which the search or seizure took place. So it can vary in different factual scenarios, but there are a number of things that might make you lose a expectation of privacy where you might otherwise have it. And one of those instances is if you tell somebody else or if you publish the information that you would otherwise have a reasonable expectation of privacy. There was a couple of court cases that involved certain data files, and the defendant at issue had actually posted the data files, uploaded them to a bulletin board site or a forum site, and sort of published them so that other people could see them. In those instances, that might be a case where you would lose Fourth Amendment expectation of privacy. And that's something that has given courts a lot of trouble with regard to email. And the argument has been that because if you're using email, there's a number of intermediaries that email physically, but the electrons are passing through as it goes from the point where you're sending it to the point of receipt from the person you've addressed it to. And because it's so easy for a person to sit in between those two points and, say, tap into one of the routers and or just be looking for information from one of the ends, which would potentially be very easy to do, like if you're sitting on a wireless network or something like that. Because a person is so easily able to read the contents of that email, it's kind of like telling somebody else the contents that you expect to be private. And in those cases, some of the courts have said that you lose that expectation of privacy. There's also other arguments that say, well, if you're using a web service, you're going through the web service, and so the web service has to would probably know the contents, or at least have them stored in some instances, and that might make you lose your expectation of privacy as well. What I really liked about what this court did is they drew analogies to both the telephone and the postal service. And in particular, one section they talked about in this case involved the postal services and how there's a number of different intermediary points. It's kind of similar to the way that emails are sent online. And that just because a postal worker could rip through the very thin paper that made up the envelope and read the contents of your letter, that doesn't diminish any of your Fourth Amendment rights to unreasonable searches and seizures by government officials.
Right. A lot of what this court was doing was trying to argue against the arguments that those previous court cases that you had mentioned, Dave, arguing against what those courts were saying. This court was saying that, you know, unless it's published, you know, somewhere very public, like on a bulletin board, or unless, you know, a third party voluntarily hands it over to the police or the investigators, you still have this expectation of privacy. It's the same with a letter. If I, you know, take a letter and I mail it to David, the fact that I've mailed the letter to David, it doesn't mean that I no longer have a reasonable expectation of privacy in it. If they want to come into my house and take that letter, they'd need a warrant. You know, if Dave wants to give them the letter, that's fine, but that doesn't mean that I don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy in it, and, you know, until that happens.
And it's not that just because you have an expectation of privacy, it doesn't mean that you're completely shielded from the government coming in and intruding on your personal life and seizing items from you. Those are usually instances where you need a warrant, just as the Fourth Amendment says quite plainly, actually. And there are a number of exceptions to this. We don't really need to get into them here, but one of the classic ones that everyone knows about is the in plain sight doctrine. For instance, if police officer happened to be driving by a house for whatever reason, and the house was really close to the road, and from the car even, the police officer was able to see what he believed to be marijuana plants growing in the house, you know, that might be an instance where a police officer might be able to enter the premises of a home. And maybe one of you guys wants to talk about the good faith exception in the Stored Communications Act.
Okay, I can do that. Essentially, Stored Communications Act held that, says that there's a lower standard to get information from internet service provider. In this case, the federal government let the ISP, let these people's ISP know that, you know, they should be storing these emails, and then essentially subpoenaed the information from the ISP. Didn't provide a warrant with probable cause. They did have to show something, but it was a lower standard than probable cause. The good faith exception to the Fourth Amendment says that if the officer is relying in good faith on a facially valid statute, then we're not going to exclude the evidence because the point of the exclusionary rule is to discourage bad behavior, and relying on a statute that seems to be valid is good behavior. So we're not going to punish people for, you know, doing things the way they thought they should have been done. Okay. Any last thoughts then, David?
Nope. I think I'm good.
Dominic?
All set.
So I just want to let all of our listeners know that we're going to be taking next week off in honor of the holidays. So enjoy time. If you're going home with your families, If you're not, go to the movies and have some Chinese food. And we'll see you after New Year's. please head over to our website, www.technicallylegal.org, or send us an email, podcast@technicallylegal.org, if you have any comments, suggestions, things you'd like to hear on the podcast. And as always, you can also follow us on Twitter. Our handle's @TechLegal. So signing off, I'm Ben Snitkoff.
I'm Dominic Rabia.
And I'm David O'Brien.
Thanks for tuning in.